This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I thought I'd make some transitional discourse to get over from painting to poetry, you know. I've always liked that phrase, stupid like a painter. There's not an exact equivalent for poetry critic. It might be something like a poetry critic. I've also always liked the notion that was brought up that it's impossible to talk about poetry, which is, I suppose, why I keep trying to do it. But I'm more and more convinced that it really is impossible to talk about poetry, and there's so many interesting poets out there these days. It's like lifting a big steel girder or something to deal with each and every one of them, thousands of them, three poetry critics left in the world. Anyway, yes. In a recent note in Boundary 2, the Irish poet Randolph Healy writes that it is possible to misrepresent the historical context of logic as a search for the truth, as a wholehearted attempt to uncover the picture of the world. Since logic's ability to uncover the picture of the world has been hopelessly compromised, and logic as the instrument of orthodoxy and the scaffolding of the world has begun to collapse under internal pressures, logic now has something more interesting to offer poetry, what Healy calls expressive potential. And that's mostly Healy there. This something more interesting, let me start that sentence again. This note is meant in part to explain tendencies in Healy's own poetry, and I don't want to make too much of it. But a philosopher or logician reading such remarks might want him to say a little more about what he means by logic or by its supposed collapse. A quick scan of the Cambridge Dictionary of Philosophy finds entries describing modes of logic called by the following names: combinatory, default, deontic, deviant, dynamic, epistemic, erotetic, formal, free, higher order, infinitary, informal, intentional, many-valued, mathematical, modal, non-monotonic, ordinal, Polish, predicate, quantum, relational, second order, symbolic, tense, terminist, and three-valued. Surely Healy does not imagine that all of these modes of logic have been discredited, but means instead to recognize that specific logical forms, he mentions the axiomatic method, are no longer the instrument of orthodoxy. Such a plurality of logics extant speaks to an end of orthodoxy. Perhaps he means also to suggest that in some more general way, the relationship of logic to knowledge is not what it once was. Aristotle viewed logic as the foundation of knowledge, for instance. Logical positivist philosophers held that language reflects the structure of the world. Healy might have such claims in mind. Audre Welles is one poet who has found her poetic practice amid the collapse of these orthodoxies. Her poems, particularly in recent collections such as Else in Substance and Begetting Textile, but also in the annotated Here and Selected poems, often inhabit or allude to logics and logical forms. Chronic Dreams, for example, one of the newer poems in the Selected Poems, mimics an algebraic problem rendered discursively. A function of X foreshadows of with less in an impaired crossing of arithmetic processes, while a number greater than a portfolio of bathers destroyed takes the product of two numbers greater than of and very stimulated in an effort to do the wrong thing for the right reasons, saying of when naming less until amnestied. For the right reasons, he gave the tablet a spatial location in haste. This amusing poem might be read as exploring the rejection of representational content in abstract art, and more especially the rationales used to defend that art by artists discussing their own work. Foreshadowing of with less in a more pedestrian idiom, which is typically mine, I might add, merely indicates that the word less comes before the word of, the opposite of what happens here. Of itself might refer to a representational content or figure the artist rejects or diminishes. We say that the abstract painting is not a painting of something. An impaired crossing might refer to the algebraic language the poem mimes and distorts, or abstraction's aesthetic theory is borrowed from discourses belonging to mathematics, logic, or metaphysics. Via acts of substitution, words stand in for numbers in the way that letters do in algebra. The poem's syntax gives and takes away, adds and subtracts, especially in the movement between the seventh and eighth lines, with their lurid portfolio of bathers, line break, destroyed. Following this line of thinking about the poem, one might notice that the suggestion that abstract art is greater than representational art, if that's what it is, gives us the language of aesthetic judgment in a dry idiom of mathematics. That phrase is comically extended in the phrase very stimulated, which might well poke fun at a particular artist or popular views of abstract artists as excitable types. The poem continues by inverting the more common order of the phrase doing the right thing for the wrong reasons, and then in its final stanza refers to a tablet given a spatial location in haste as an act performed for the right reasons, which would seem to suggest the poem's concluding affirmation of intuition as part of the practice of the artist, after a previous line indicates that his or her after-the-fact explanations might need to be amnestied, as that odd idiom has it. My crude paraphrase shaves the poem of its sharp edges and turns, and I can only guess at the meaning of the title. Perhaps it refers to a kind of guilt or uncertainty regularly accompanying the contemplation of composition after the fact, or alternatively to a proposed relationship between intuitive logics and artistic creation. Whatever we make of the poem, it is its unusual language that we notice first, this sense that a manner of speaking or writing found most often in one kind of problem solving has been moved over for use in another. Algebra will have a host of associations that might well exist at some distance from our thinking about art, or perhaps this is true only of those like myself who lack a stable or synthetic vision of the relationship between different kinds of knowledge. It might be that those associations are such for some of us that the wit of this poem will seem routine, dry, as I said above, as if this is what algebra itself is. I suspect that some readers will have altogether missed the humorous moments in the poem. This and other related poems do not propose a critique of logical forms. If logics provide a means of inferring or discovering knowledge via procedures for ordering discourse and thought, if they offer modes of reasoning, these poems inhabit these modes for aesthetic ends, for the purposes of the poem. They empty logical forms of their typical function, and in so doing, raise ancient questions about art and knowledge. I wish I could extract that banality. They also disable logical propositions and orders. It is difficult to imagine how it would be possible to understand or describe what happens in chronic dreams as any known mode of discursive reasoning exactly, for the content of phrases such as the one about the bathers overrides their place or function in the mock equation. That is part of what I mean above by using the word lurid, that dissonance of form and content. Read dialectically, this emptying of logical form of its content, or more broadly, this addition of elements of indeterminacy and surprise to ideas of order and reasoning, affirms these same logics and orders, extends their purchase or use. Form is preserved absent its typical functions. The poem might thus be read either as critique of aesthetic freedom or critique of logical form, or as both. But thinking of them as critique is probably the wrong approach in the first place. Of course, critique, with the many meanings the word might have, has lately been one of the modes of discourse which poetry has been aligned with in academic and other discussions of innovative or avant-garde poetry. Some of this poetry employs related modes of mixing discourses or categories of discourse. Welsh's poems implode such categories, as they are sometimes held apart, the logical and the aesthetic, but that act need not seek to diminish the value of any particular mode of knowledge. We might look at another, perhaps richer, example. Else in Substance, a poem full of allusions to the languages of logics. This poem is written in couplets. As a literary form, the couplet has a history of associations, but little of that history seems important to this poem. Here the couplet is of interest for its ability to present, investigate, model and complicate binary and either-or reasoning. This couplet is a visual and logical form, that is, paired lines allowing the reader to consider the relationship between short noun phrases that make up each line in the couplet, and beyond that, the relationships of individual couplets in a series of couplets. The end-stop lines and phrases of the poem's first couplet establish the pattern that the poem later interrupts. The dress, the other dress, the recurrent dress, the perpetual dress, the basic dress, the reductive dress, the little dress, the little black dress, the opaque dress, the remote dress, the opaque dress, the mute dress. The title's reference to substance identifies one point of the repetition of the word dress. Substance, the Cambridge Dictionary of Philosophy tells us, was defined by Aristotle in his categories as that which is neither predicable of anything nor present in anything as an aspect or property of it. We can predicate being a horse of something, but not a horse, nor is a horse in something else, unless it's a movie, I suppose. Substance for Aristotle was what remained self-identical through change. All other things are accidents of substances and exist only as aspects, properties, or relations of substances. Aristotle did not have the last word on the matter, of course. That sort of rhymes with horse, it occurs to me. I could break into a song here now, but I'll try to avoid that. We can trace a debate concerning substance through Hume, who denied the existence of substances and instead held that things are bundles of properties, and beyond him to bundle theory and the latest physics. In discussing substance, we are, of course, talking about a series of related questions involving essences, self-identity, identity and difference, and the thing. And all of that is figured in this poem's dress, its composition, or perhaps I should say costume. The poem begins simply allowing us to consider basic relationships between paired terms, one dress, the other dress, and then in its second couplet distinguishes the recurrent and the perpetual. Already by this point, our attention to the dress itself has probably been stripped. We know what game we are playing. In the third couplet, Welsh used terms that factor in what logical positivists call the verifiability criterion of meaning. Much as later in the poem, necessary and contingent dresses allude to kinds of truth, as referred to in logical positivism. In the fourth couplet's second line, the addition of the word black distinguishes not only by adding specific color, but also by alluding to Coco Chanel's famous dress, thereby producing a category error, a merely descriptive term matched with one conjuring with an entire cultural history. Adjectives in the fifth couplet make for a more mysterious, possibly inexplicable pairing. And then in the sixth, the couplets reject one of the rules of the poem to this point, the rule that no adjective will be repeated. At this point, the poem altogether interrupts the pattern of end-stopped paired noun phrases. Reply that rhetorical dress happens frequently, happens sufficiently, in explicit instances in the works of X. Variation within the simplest of forms, but it is the form itself that allows such variation to show up. Rhetorical dress suggests rhetorical address, so even the substance of the word as word is shadowed by difference, by the else of the poem's title. The poem seems to insist on this else throughout the lines following these, which state that realizing the ideal cannot be in objects. If I stop the phrase there, the poem seems to be stating that the object can have no essence or ideal, but I've cut the sentence off. The turns its syntax takes are more complex. Cannot be in objects such as these, lexicons, not self-identical, as of forgetful Greece, say again in memoriam, happens always, frequently, in prophetic dress, of explicit instances, Helen, merely a limiting case. Looking again at my handy dictionary of philosophy, we see that a limiting case is an individual or subclass of a given background that is maximally remote from typical or paradigm members of the class with respect to some ordering that is not always explicitly mentioned. If Helen is or was a realized ideal, she is not a typical but rather a limiting case. But was Helen a realized ideal? Helen is also a lesson in the danger of ideals, a lesson much repeated throughout some of our histories. Say again, say again. If Greece is forgetful, some of us are not, or not always. Complexity beyond the distinction between typical and limiting cases seems to be indicated. You might say that I am taking some liberties with this paraphrase, which would in turn affirm what these lines say about lexicons not self-identical, and also what I began with by saying about criticism and its pedestrian functions. In any event, the poem shows us something else beyond the either-or structure the couplets hint at or are structured by. The couplets themselves present this something else. These lines end the poem. Else, passum, intuitions, either or, and 1/8, without dress, throughout dress. Intuitions not as opposed to logics, but as a kind of supplement to logics or as other logics, the otherwise or the else, not as what leaves us without the dress, without the costumes that dress our world, but as already evident throughout them. Fuzzy dresses. You'll forgive me. Wellish's poems often tell us what they are doing as they are doing it. To the artifice's winding pass we lend our gloss, she writes in another poem from Else in Substance entitled Less Music. The word gloss there, like the word annotation and description in other poems, identifies another dimension of her practice. That's somewhat arbitrary to separate it out the way I'm doing it here. I'm not altogether certain how to relate it to what I've said above, to that interest in logics that extends even to allusions, or possible allusions, to the as-if fictive reasoning of Hans Wehinger. The idea of glossing or annotating the word as word, logical form as logical form, and poem as poem, folds self-reflexive activity within a constructivist poetic, though I'm not altogether happy with that formulation. Possibly it accounts for what to some readers seems like a highly intellectualized practice. While Wellish's is a poetry that seems to value what we might associate with the intuitive, with what she calls in her art criticism the open work, with discovery and surprise, and to cite a few more words from Less Music, the multicursal and continuous, as these make for devastating complexity, such self-reflexive moments suggest a kind of rigorous self-consciousness some would find more typical of theory than poetry. I cannot think of poems more recursive in their movement than the first and title poem of the annotated here in Selected Poems, which might be read as a kind of ars poetica. Reference to a winding artifice glossed in Less Music is akin to mention of a parallelism of focus and setting out in that poem. Focus suggests discipline and plan, setting out, a beginning, looking ahead, a journey or investigation, exploration, openness, and so on. One might propose alternatives to these associations, but the terms focus and setting out aren't opposed exactly anyway. That is the point, but parallel. If rigor is possible only within a known system or discourse, it is impossible to be both original and rigorous. I stole that from Richard Rorty, by the way. Unfootnoted here. But in their movement, Wellish's poems would seem to offer the contrary impression by managing to be both precise and inexplicable, or to give us that impression anyway. Intellection is suggested by recursive movement, iteration and reiteration, as it gathers and unravels previously offered phrases and words, text as textile, as in the title of one pamphlet. This can seem to slow the movement of the poem, even at the cost of a certain fluidity of phrase often described as poetic musicality. The title Less Music perhaps alludes to the prosaic nature of some of the poems. Less music, more thought, the equation might be. There is a music of phrasal and syntactical repetition in Wellish's poems, but there is little trace of the bardic and oral, nothing akin to what one finds in a post-minimalist poem like John Taggart's Not This, Not That, for instance. Syntactic repetition is not new in Welsh's poems. We find it, for instance, in Among Them All from her first book. I think it's the first book, handwritten. And here it is. A car turning onto a driveway, an activity that slows down activity, also a routine associated with domestic life heard from inside. The front tires passing through a puddle and dully hitting a curb, then the rear tires passing through the same, rolling onto the same soothing routine, make me think that after rain, each dip is an excuse to change timber. The wet, the partially wet sounds of paint rollers pushed from the gutter of a tray are the tires also. I remember now I heard the car approach. Its description ushered softly forward, growing louder, turning. In an email to me discussing this poem and others, Wallace writes that this early poem indicates my interest in repetition as a tactic to enable structural and semiotic translation. The poem is metonymic where it might be metaphoric, which befits a poet who has worked variations and translations on one of William Carlos Williams's most famous poems in her sequence, The Black Poems. Another poet working in another mode would have been satisfied with simile. The rolling of car wheels is like, or reminds me of, paint rollers dipping in pan or tray. But in the end, it is not the observation of likeness that is notable in this poem, but sentence and phrasal repetitions, rhythms rather, parallelisms and repetitions as they offer a slightly ominous, deliberate turning. And I'll assume that you know some of the relationship of that word to verse itself. We might even say that the poem is about describing turning, although that about is in quotation marks, and it certainly describes turning. The first stanza seemed to issue in that phrase, its description set apart as a penultimate line. Thus it is not only repetition, but also self-reflexivity that is present in Welsh's poetry from the beginning, though I would argue that this self-reflexivity, or as I call it above, glossing or annotating, is pushed forward more common, that is more common in recent poems. In his book, The Muses, Jean-Luc Nancy argues that Hegel's famous definition of art as the sensible representation of the idea can be read as indicating the dialectical necessity that the idea go outside itself in order to be itself. This reading of Hegel's definition is meant to complicate oppositions between the abstract and the concrete, inside and outside, invisible and visible, and so on. I happen to be reading these remarks while just beginning to think about Welsh's poetry and this paper, or for the purposes of this paper, and thus happened to turn to a translation of Hegel's Aesthetics, where I found in the following sentence from the preface the word here placed in italics. Voila, I thought. Through the power of philosophic thinking, we are able to soar above what is merely here, above sensuous and finite experience. I thought immediately of the quotation marks placed around here in the title poem of Welsh's selected poems. After all, Welsh is on record in an interview with Daniel Kane for having said that sense data have been largely overrated. And I had the idea momentarily of reading her work within this Hegelian proposition. But then I knew it was just too good for words. But Welsh would seem to relish... But Welsh would seem to relish works of art that resist the kinds of future synthesis proposed by Hegel in that same preface. Spirit can heal the breach between the supersensuous, this is Hegel rather than Welsh. Spirit can heal the breach between the supersensuous and the sensuous brought on by its own advance. It produces out of itself the world of fine art as the first reconciling medium between what is merely external, sensuous, and transient, and the world of pure thought, between nature with its finite reality and the infinite freedom of philosophic reason. Welsh follows her own observation about the status of sense data by telling Kane that, this having been said, the cultural value of putting our ideological or expressive cliches to the test by observing matters firsthand provides us with crucial help in gauging the weaknesses of ideas. That's an important sentence in the Welsh interview archive, I think. Looking critically both ways, Welsh would seem to want to resist absorption into idea without falling back on the senses or empiricism in any naive fashion. Similarly, in what I suppose might be called a mode of philosophic realism, she seeks to preserve consciousness of the limits of representation within the practice of what she calls in one passage, in signifying art, the practice of what she calls in one passage in Signifying Art, phenomenological description. In her art critical working on the minimalist sculptor Donald Judge, she admires the way that his work presents us with abstract objects, frustrating our efforts to name and categorize them. And this is Marguerite. Words replace object of experience, and with Judge's objects, which feign synonymy with the cube, words replace objects readily. Thus, to frustrate this synonymy, Judd adjusts the proposed object so that it falls between names and categories of reference. Put another way, as in Adorno's cultural theory, the irreconcilability of concept and object is integral to art, and thus deliberately exploited by Judd is the dimensional conundrum of the not cube and the unbox-like box relative to the essentializing words of cube and box. Wellish writes of postponing classification, and this postponing seems to take on ethical weight for her. It should not be difficult to see the ways in which description giving way to redescription and to self-consciousness about description figures in her poems addressing Judd's work, which I think are the three poems beginning with this near that in her selected poems. These poems, like others in the annotated here and selected poems and in other volumes, make considerable use of citation. Perhaps the citations are descriptions of Judd's work, but the equivalent of Judd's box in Wellish's poems, the objects that are described and redescribed as a means of delaying any final naming, are the words themselves, sentences and structures of the poems. She tells Daniel Kane that this near that is decidedly not about merely matching a verbal resemblance to a visual art object, but it does make a certain use of ekphrasis for noting the logical disposition of the work. The object in question is the logical description, together with the functional description of the structural complex called a box, unquote. Self-reflexivity in Wellish's poems thus refers to the act of commenting on the poem as an object within a logical disposition, which is to say not a shape so much as a structure and purpose within a system. Any commentary on the poem is part of the poem. Temporal and spatial descriptions that divide our attention to the poem or allow us to forget the contingencies at play in our engagement with the work do not serve us well. So too are mathematical and literary forms made contingent on the ruminative marks that produce them, Wellish writes, noting Twombly's proposal that these marks, quote, are speculative instruments perennially delving into the nature of their own visual existence. Last paragraph. For Bob Perlman. When I first read the title poem of Wellish's selected poems, I wanted to read the quotation marks around here as scare quotes, indicating an ironizing of the word here and pointing to a distinction between the word here on the page and any possible real location of the poem's speakers. Here refers to the poem itself, I thought, proud of my cleverness. This reading searches out playfulness as if in using the phrase this table or this podium while reading my essay aloud, I pointed to the podium in front of me. But there is little irony in Wellish's work. Rather, the quotes around the word here in her title identify the word here as simply undergoing scrutiny. They also disappear in the poem below, which insists upon the demands made by or in actual space, as opposed to other spaces. The here of actual space, addressed in face, to face, proximally, yet aesthetically in pencil, like an eyelash addressing the canvas, which tantalizes. Let me read that one again, these lines again. The here of actual space, addressed in face, to face, proximally, yet aesthetically in pencil, like an eyelash addressing the canvas, which tantalizes. In face perhaps gives us the person visibly marked by her environment, context, and activity. To face insists upon the ethical agency of artistic response. Any response to the artwork will usefully acknowledge our distance from it and the inexactitude of our description. What we do in responding to art, as also experience, will be akin to probing rather than seizing or capturing. Proximate and aesthetic, focus and setting out, context and possibility. The poems delay naming to remember or preserve the difficult otherness of the object, preferring the experience of classification to classifications. The eyelash might be crucial, for it proposes that responsiveness is erotic as well as ethical. One might even speak of a poetics of the eyelash. Actually read that backwards. Is ethical, responsiveness is ethical as well as erotic. Whatever. One might even speak of a poetics of the eyelash. The eyelash is between eye and object of vision, in motion more often than not. It has been eroticized. It keeps dirt out of the eye. Thanks. I meant to move around a little more, but I stood there like a stone. Yes?
My question was about else in substance. I'm a little trepidatious to ask it, but I'm just going to go ahead. My initial misreading of this poem's title was Elsa in substance. When I first was reading it, I imagined a woman's name. And as soon as I scanned the lines, the dress, the other dress, the little black dress, I was aware of the figure of a woman who was trying to place herself in a context of this dress. And when you asked in your remarks, when you remarked that by the second or third series of couplets, the dress itself has vanished or dematerialized, I was wondering, because I had the image of Elsa still in my mind, or the image of the woman figure trying to fit into the dress, what happens to the dress? In the same way, in the interview that you were talking about, where Marjorie tries via a poem to describe a box, at some point the box appears when you recognize it, and then it disappears again, it dematerializes again. And I was kind of wondering, in regard to another poet that was mentioned in your introduction, Mina Loy, if there's any guidance in her poetics for the relationship that the object, you know, of a woman fitting into a dress has to do with the interpretation of that.
Well, let me first of all say that I don't think there are misreadings of poems, exactly. Thank God. Otherwise, I'd be out of business in a hurry. In terms of, that's more a comment than a question. Actually, I'm glad you mentioned Mina Loy, because I'm disappointed that I didn't figure out a way to work Mina Loy into this talk, because Marjorie's work actually in some ways reminds me of Mina Loy's work, and I think its reception, insofar as it's had any reception, is interestingly parallel. That is to say that Mina Loy was taken at first as a sort of hyper-intellectual poet using idioms and dictions that were willfully non-poetic, or just simply ugly, I guess would be the word. And Rachel would know a lot about this as well. And I think there's a sense in which Marjorie's work might be vulnerable, if it had received a lot of attention, as unfortunately it hasn't, might receive some of the same kinds of responses. I'm thinking in particular of a response I saw on Amazon.com as I was sort of prowling around to see what was on the net to the selected poems, which, you know, Amazon is an interesting place to study reviewing, because just the most evil sorts of things can be said there with apparent total freedom. As I know, that's right. No, not exactly. But the really evil ones are written by other poets. Probably those people that are living around the block from you. But there was a remark about the poems there which suggested that they were kind of arid. And the theory of theory was the phrase, I think I remember. And partly I was thinking about that as I was writing this, and thinking about a parallel with Loy, and then I think that Mina Loy's work is profoundly erotic. Exactly, because for the way it defies predictable idioms and defies and establishes a kind of distance from its, probes the object rather than tries to fix it. And there are continuities there. I'd have to think a lot harder about how to phrase them eloquently or not, as I'm trying to, as I'm doing here. Yes. I do go on. The futility of criticism is increasingly apparent to me. Yes. Anything else? Yes.
I quite agree. I'm glad you mentioned this link, that I would have mentioned it as a normal response to Marjorie, distinctly mineral, and thinking of what Kant called mineralized time, hydrophilia, which I think could work very well with this kind of philosophical and erotic intermixing of language, quotes, and so on.
But Kant also said that both Marion Moore and Nina Loy, who he was reviewing ensemble, did not have any emotion, which is very much linked to what you were saying. They had no emotion in their poetry, which was, in other words, they had no recognizable emotion and no female emotion that he could recognize as being female, as in...
emotional like a woman.
Or what women would normally think to write about.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an important point to be made about Marjorie's work, and probably should be made directly and straightforwardly. I would like to have talked. Partly what you're beginning to talk about is gender in a more broader cultural framework and women's poetry, and that in quotes, yes, and sort of expectations for that, and vis-a-vis lyricism and eroticism. And of course, you've written quite elegantly on that yourself, and smartly, intelligently. And yeah, I should have said more about that eroticism in the work, but I thought I'm saying it now. Yes, so there it is. It says right here. Yes, anything else? Okay, I will give over to Norma.